Okay, this is an interview with Vince Catolica in San Francisco at radio station KALW on February, let's see, this is the 6th, 1994.
That's right.
This is Dave Radlauer at the KALW studios with Vince Catolica. Welcome, Vince. Good to have you here.
Well, it's good to be here. I'll tell a few of my stories.
Great. Vince is an outstanding clarinet and reed player who's been performing in the San Francisco Bay Area for, 40, 50 years, Vince?
Since June of 1943.
And you were born and raised in San Francisco.
As I said before, yeah, I was born in San Francisco. I was born on Powell Street by Francisco Junior High School, and they brought me over to my flat where I'm living now when I was a year old. And I did move for a while, but most of my life has been spent in that flat, and I'm 70 years old.
How old were you when you started music?
When I what?
When you first started music, how old were you?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
How old were you when you first started music, and was clarinet your first instrument?
Oh, yeah, well, I started music when I was 10 years old. I beg your pardon, yeah, 12 years old. And I've been playing since September of 1935, clarinet and some tenor saxophone.
So you were about, 11 or 12 then, 11 or 12 years old when you started?
Yeah.
And were you playing classically at first? Were you taking lessons,
or
did you start
with jazz? Little braille music here and there along the way. It was a band teacher, there were 150 children, boys and girls, from the age of 6 to 18. So when you were around 12, they put you in a little band with a clarinet or a kazoo or a tambourine, a triangle. And I got the clarinet and just kept on noodling after a couple of years. You want to hear a story?
Yeah, okay, absolutely.
Okay, here comes your first story. Well, I sort of just fooled around with it until I was about 14. And I'm the last of seven children. And by the time I was 14, I realized that everybody else, the other six children, had odd jobs. My three sisters worked in the Levi Strauss original factory in the 30s, the ones that make the jeans and so forth and so on. And so I thought, geez, everybody's doing something, so I got to do something. So by the time I was 14, I really started practicing 4 hours a day and, developing bad habits on the instrument till somebody came along and said, no, do it this way and you'll get more action out of the clarinet. So I've been still doing, but I stopped. I stopped New Year's Eve. Nobody's going to tell me I'm doing it wrong because I'm not going to play anymore.
So your official retirement was December 31st, 1993?
That's right, yeah. I've done it before, but this time it's for real.
Any particular reason?
Well, mostly physical condition, a little bit of arthritis in the hands, maybe the lack of hearing something that I should be hearing. And I get tired of standing pretty fast now. Well, I walk about an hour and a half a day, but just standing throws me off. And to be straight out, some of the things you play, for me, they bothered me through the night and through the day of something I played the previous night.
You didn't feel that you were playing at your best?
I felt I was playing pretty good, but some of the things I was doing disturbed me, and I started to figure all this out last September. So I told LaVey Smith, and that's the lady I worked for, and Mal Sharp. I was playing in a band over there with him, and I told both of them, I said, this is it, I want out. And I went till the end of the year with LaVey Smith, but Mal let me out within a couple of weeks. That's all.
This is Dave Radlauer at KALW with Vince Catolica, a retired clarinet player in San Francisco. And a bit later in the program, we are going to hear some of the recordings, studio recordings Vince made with LaVey Smith and the small swing band of Chris Seabird and the Skillet Lickers. But let's try and get on to some of the music here. You want to tell us about Jack Sheedy.
Yes, I can tell you a great deal about Jack Sheedy. I started rehearsing with him in January of 1949. This was a Dixieland band. This was Jack Sheedy, trombone and leader, Jack Minger, cornet, Vince Catalica, clarinet, and, oh boy.
I've got all the personnel listed. Yeah, all right. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
Was Sheedy from New Orleans?
No. Sheedy was, I think, from the state of Washington. And ended up here because he was an ensign in the Navy, you know, type thing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as gradually these men, as they got out, they just stayed where they got out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he organized this band, and I'll tell you a story about that. We made these four sides in May of 1949, and it was all speculation. Another four sides were made, but I was not on those. Paul Desmond, the alto player, really, actually, he was a clarinet. He was an alto saxophone player, but he was a master clarinet player. Not too many people know that. By the age of around 15, 16, 17 years old, Paul was a master clarinet player. That's it. But an interesting part, there's more to this. If you want to hear more of it?
Go, tell us.
Okay.
That's great stuff.
Okay, well, we got a job in a place called The Hangover. You're familiar with that.
Here in San Francisco.
In San Francisco on Bush Street. And we started to play there three nights a week. Then by around 3 weeks, we ended up playing five nights a week. By a couple of weeks after that, we were playing six nights a week. Now, during this time, a washing machine salesman by the name of Jerry Hecker convinced Doc that he should bring in some of the New York boys.
You're speaking of Doc Doherty, the owner of the
That's
club
right,
Hangover.
That's right, Doc Doherty. I wanted to get his name out, but you got it. That's right. And he brought in on a Sunday night Albert Nicholas, Schmidt, his trombone player from Bob Crosby's band, and Wild Bill Davidson.
Oh, boy.
They were the front line. This was a Sunday night. I knew they were going to be there, you know, and I was not quite 30 years old and totally blind and realizing that I had made it because we really packed the place six nights a week. And I went down to hear these guys, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they were very, naturally, that was the cream of the crop. So I went home and just crawled into bed and said, well, that's it, you know. And sure enough, about 3 weeks later, they got a job for us in San Jose at a club for 2 weeks. We played there and then came back to The Hangover for 4 weeks. And after that, we were given our two-week notice, union two-week notice, and then Doc brought in, Charlie Levere, all of them. You've heard them all.
Yeah, the whole list.
The whole works, including Louie and Jack Teagarden, and I never played there after that. I went in there after that to hear Henry Red Allen and a group that came in there, and then I went in there to hear Buddy DeFranco. And if I may continue... Jack recorded Dave Brubeck later in 1949, and it was Dave Brubeck, Cal Jader, and the bass player, and I can't think of his name. Anyway, this was the group that played on a program ran by Jimmy Lyons called Lyons Busy.
Mm-hmm.
This was on—
A broadcast series?
Pardon me?
A broadcast series?
Oh, yeah. This was broadcast on once a week, I believe, on K. At that time, it was called KNBC.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jack decided to record.
What type of a band was it? Was this more progressive?
Oh, it was a trio, vibes, the original trio, vibes, bass, and piano. Cal Jader played vibes, and Dave Brubeck and Ron Crotty played bass.
Mm-hmm.
That was the group that went on there. And at the same time, Jack Sheedy decided to record them.
I see.
He made the original four sides on the Jack Sheedy label called Coronet Records.
Oh, yes, I've got
those. I bet you won't edit much of this part. It's wild. So after a while, Jack got hung up for money. So he sold, I believe it was sold the four masters for $150.
Oh, boy.
And now you know the rest of the story, because this is how Fantasy Records came about.
Oh, yes. Okay, so who got the Brubeck tapes then?
Fantasy Records.
Fantasy, and that was the beginning of Fantasy.
That's it.
That's right, and that was the house that Brubeck built, more or less.
Yeah.
In the early days, anyway.
I think that story can be verified by Jack Sheedy himself, that lives in New York City, verified by Jimmy Lyons himself, Joe Dodge, the drummer, Jack Minger, Bull Reuther, the bass player. They'll verify what I have just
told
you.
So Sheedy's still alive. Are you in contact with him at all, or what do you know of what he's doing these days?
Well, he lives in New York City and had a stroke, mild stroke. He can talk. He's, working his way back. How far he will come back, I don't. Nobody knows anything about those things when we have.
What was he doing before his stroke, though? Was he? He was playing music.
He was playing music in New York, rehearsing, trying to learn to read better, trying to improve his playing. He was basically retired. He was a school teacher.
Uh huh.
Yeah, he got a degree in literature at scholarship. Two years of scholarship at Stanford, yeah.
Now, getting back briefly to the Sheedy band at the Club Hangover, this would have been fairly early, wouldn't it have been, for the Club Hangover, like...
Oh, yes, we started...
48, 49, somewhere
yes, sir,
in there?
49. We started the Club Hangover. We started there three nights a week, then five nights and six nights. We were packing the place.
Now, this was before the radio hookups, though, or did you do any radio broadcasts?
Oh, no, the hookups came after that.
Mm-hmm.
You want to hear another story?
Sure.
Well, this was told to me by Earl Hines. You know, you've probably played them, these little records that the Earl Hines band with Muggsy.
Oh, yeah. I've got access to the originals of those, tapes.
That was really, Darnell was taping that.
Now, didn't you play with Hines a couple of times at Club
Hangover? I played just some casuals with Hines, but I didn't play the Hangover.
Oh, I see.
I played with Bob Scobie's band for several nights. I replaced Bill Napier, the famous clarinet player.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm just sort of... the hand-me-down.
How about Ralph Sutton? Was that in town here?
I played with Ralph Sutton down at Bach Dynamite Dancing Society.
Oh, yeah.
Ralph Sutton and John Markham and John Mosier, drums and bass and clarinet. And
that sounds more like the 60s, though.
Yeah, that was... that was 1977, 76.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got you off the topic of the early... Club Hangover. There.
Yeah, well, what those tapes, those records were made by Darnell Howard, but they weren't supposed to be released, but they got out. Earl Hines told me this. I worked in the Fairmont in the New Orleans room for 10 years, and Earl Hines came in one night, and we got to talking, and he was a little bit put out that those records were brought out and not, not on his say-so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That happens. Anything else you can tell us about the Sheedy Band? Did you go to L.A. at all? Because he was active in L.A., wasn't he, for a while?
Is that just where the
Cornet recordings were made?
I can only tell you that I went to L.A. See, we were working, everybody worked strip joints. We all worked what they call the tenderloin. But
in San Francisco here?
Yeah, but the tenderloin was not like it is now at all. You could walk out with three girls on any given night, drunker than all get out, and nobody disturbed you in the city. You could walk the whole city blindfolded, and at that time, nobody would disturb you.
So a lot of the pleasures were available, but not without the dangers of today.
Pardon me?
I was saying, there a lot of the pleasures were available, but without the dangers.
Absolutely, yeah. It was just beautiful. We mustn't talk about that, I guess, too much, because then people are going to say, I better stay home. But I played, one of the bands I played with a guy by the name of Chuck Travis.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you about Chuck.
Yeah, saxophone player. This is how we went to L.A. We were playing a place called the Chez Paris. We went in there in October of 1944. I had played already on Turk Street. I started on Turk Street, and in January, I went into the same band. We went into a place called The Backstage. That was a prominent jazz club here, and I must stay on that. That was a place where Saunders King...
I've heard of him.
Yeah, Saunders King, Saunders King guitar, Joe Holder on bass, and Bernard Peters on drums, Sammy Dean on trumpet, and the piano player's name at the time, I haven't got it now, but that was a big jazz club in San Francisco. Anyway,
what was the name of it again?
Called the Backstage.
Backstage.
It was on Powell Street, right below O'Farrell. Uh-huh. And on O'Farrell Street was Slapsy Maxie's. Rosenblum, the fighter, he had a club there, and big names came there too, upstairs. And one band that came in there was Henry Red Allen, J.C. Hickenbotham, and Don Stovall were in the front line. And oh man, boy, that was because I played downstairs. Now we're kind of going off for a minute, but I'll get back to it. This is after I came back from L.A. But that was Henry Red Allen. You know, just. Well, anyway, so in October, we played two tenors, Chuck and I, and a girl by the name of Violet Trent, Cousino, who became a disc jockey. He was a drummer and became a disc jockey on K-Jazz until his illness, and he passed away, and Norman Bates, the bass player. We played for strippers at the Chez Paris, and... Then in January, Chuck decided that we were to leave this job and go to Los Angeles. And that's how I went to Los Angeles. And there was a lot of furor. My older brother said, go to Los Angeles. You know, you're making $85 a week. Your unemployment's being taken out. Your Social Security, you're making a good wage, although we worked 6 hours. Mm-hmm. We worked from... 4 to 12, they closed the bars then. That's 8 hours.
But there was a steady job there at the Hangover? That was a union job at the Hangover?
Oh, that was a union job at the Hangover. It was all union then, but I'm speaking about the Chez Paris, mm-hmm. where we played for the strippers. So all we went to Los Angeles, and we played all kinds of clubs, swing nights, you know, where we got the night off. And one of the nights off, we played...
Do you want me to go on, David?
Hey, just give me as much as you want.
we played for a guy that sang all kinds of blues and shouting stuff, and he just kept on playing, and we played for him all night practically. And the drummer, this is Cuz Cousino, said, that guy has a hole in his sock, right in the heel of his sock. You know, and so everybody, you know, I couldn't see it, but I laughed anyway. Anyway, it turns out about two years later, a guy came out with a song called That's My Desire, and it was Frankie Lane.
Oh, boy. This is the guy with the hole in his song.
Yeah, he was unknown then. Yeah, this might just bore the radio audience, but all these stories are true.
Well, the stories that I think a lot of people find fascinating are about the jazz life in San Francisco in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Because San Francisco was not known nationally as a big jazz town, but it's always had a strong jazz culture here.
How do you say it? Underlining, it was like a cult. Is that the way you say it? It wasn't as broad as it is now. Now, I mean, for instance, just to get off for a minute, Harvey Robb, the tenor man that's sitting alongside me, he plays in this band with LaVey Smith, and they play a place called Café du Nord on Saturday nights. And
currently, what, Monday nights at Enrico's?
At Enrico's. It's a smaller group, but the group that plays, and I will give you all of their names, the group that plays there, just to get off for a minute, they're packing them in. When I was there, they're packing them in. That place is packing them in 6 or 7 nights a week. It's got something different. And I'll get on that, too. So that the jazz feel from... I think we have to give Doc credit, Doc Doherty, for opening that place, because that place started, he started bringing in all these stars, and it was, well, Doc ran it. We ran it from April of 1949 to August of 1961.
But there's also something that happened in San Francisco, which seems like you had players who were surprisingly progressive, like a Ralph Sutton or an Earl Hines, or even Jack Teagarden, who was a swing guy, but when they got into the club hangover, it seemed like Doc expected them to play Dixieland no matter what. You have any comment on that?
I don't know exactly. I don't think they deviated from much of what they ordinarily played. As far as I could remember, they played the idiom, the Dixieland idiom, as far as I can remember. Joe Sullivan played there.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe was the intermission piano player. And Joe played his all of his rags. You know, I don't think they changed.
Mm-hmm.
The only time Doc changed is when he brought in Buddy DeFranco, Curly Russell, Art Blakey, and Kenny Drew.
Mm-hmm.
It changed.
Which would have been what?
That was in 1950.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you, Dave, we had a club here called the Say When Club.
Now, that's one I haven't heard of.
That was just about 2 blocks down from the hangover. Have you interviewed anybody that's done this type of thing with you that I'm doing now?
Oh, yeah. Bob Mielke's talked about some of the clubs.
Did he talk about the Say When Club?
Not that one, no.
Yeah, well, the Say When Club, he brought in the likes of everybody. He brought in Nellie Letcher, who was a great entertainer and just beautiful woman. Oh, boy. And he brought in Johnny Hodges' Castle Rock Band. That was 1952. That was Al Sears and... Lawrence Brown, Johnny Hodges, I can't remember the rest of the Leroy Lovett on piano. He brought in. This guy was called Dutch Neiman. He brought in all kinds of. He brought in Al Hibbler. He brought in a group with Edmund Hall. So then of course there was the Blackhawk. Now the Black.
Oh, yeah.
Pardon me.
Go ahead.
The Blackhawk got started later, and it started kind of with Dave Brubeck, and then that just went hell-bent for leather, too, even to the point where they had a section for teenagers. I think that was the first club that had a section for teenagers.
Uh-huh, a special area they could let them in and serve them non-alcoholic drinks.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this city, the only problem that you know, because I said I'll get to this, the only problem, the only thing that's being done wrong, and, you know, this is foresight, this isn't hindsight, in the times that we played all these joints and played a little bit of jazz, riff, like with Chuck Travis, it was 2 tenors, we played Cottontail, Apple Honey, Willie Herman's Apple Honey, the usual standards, and then Chuck would take a couple choruses, I'd put my tenor down. And
when you
then
say
I'd
standards, it sounds like swing standards.
Yeah, this was a swing band. I hadn't gotten into the Dixieland bands. I got into the Dixieland bands in 1949 with Jack Sheedy. See, as a kid, I was listening to Benny Goodman with one ear, and with the other ear, I was listening to Bonnie Bogart and Sidney Bechet. I mean, I come from in a kind of just like Bob Wilbur.
Mm-hmm. I know Bob.
Same thing. Same identical thing. Only I'm no Bob Wilbur. You know, I have my thing, whatever I do. You know, but I'm not a Bob Wilbur. I don't worry about that. But we played. We played riffs, and people came to hear us, but it did gain. It always has had. When they brought back the Dixieland with Lou Waters.
Yeah.
Now that band played at where Big Bear or someplace up in the hills in Berkeley till they got him into the Dawn Club.
Yeah.
You know, and now we're in 1942. They went in the service. They all came back and they went to first they went back into the Dawn Club. Then they went to Hambone Kelly's. Then it fell apart. They had a band. They all broke up, and Bob Scobie got Victors and Roxy's. Have you ever heard of that club?
No, that's a new one to me. Victors and Roxy's.
Victors and Roxy's
Bay?
over in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
I can't give you the exact address, but that was in Oakland, and that was a big band. I was a big club that the only band that played there was. Bob Scobie, the original place, I can't remember the original place where Dave, the Geary Cellar, Dave Brubeck, Norman Bates, and a saxophone player called Dave Cutler, and a young woman at that time, Frances Lynn, the singer. And that goes back to, 1948, 47. Then Dave moved with the other trio to a place over in Oakland. Yeah, I don't remember the name of that. Maybe Joe Dodge would. But, you know, so that's how...
Just to keep this focused a little bit, I want to keep it focused a little bit on some of the music we have on hand. And I first met you, Vince, when you were playing with Jimmy Diamond. And that was when I first got a chance to hear you and record you.
Yeah.
But when did you first meet Jimmy?
All right. Well, I first met Jimmy, I was working at Pier 23. And this man and woman, this was in 1962. And the incident came about that I was playing at Pier 23. And this couple came in and they said, we're going to have a party. And we're going to have Jimmy Diamond's society band. But we want you to play in that band. We want you to do something. So they said, call Jimmy Diamond and tell him that you got to be hired to just do something. So here was this 15-piece band, and Jimmy and I called him up, and I said, Jim, my name is Vince Catolica. Well, I know who you are, you know, and people had heard of me from time to time. Mm-hmm. And I told him that Pat Michaels wants me to play in your band, so you got to hire me. And he said, okay. He said, we'll find something for you to do. So I noodled around in a 15-piece band, and after that he hired me for various jobs.
What type of arrangements? It sounds like it was more of a big band or a swing band.
Oh, it was kind of a society band. So mm-hmm. The things I did were a couple of medleys, and I played just with him in the rhythm section. I can even remember I played about four choruses of Indiana, and we were out. And at that time, there was that Stranger on the Shore,
mm-hmm.
and I played that. And that's about all I played. I don't remember exactly how much I got paid. I think scale then was about $50 for 4 hours.
But then you went on to play with Jimmy for several years in a slightly different context.
Oh, sure. We went on to Casuals, and... there was a trumpet player that's on this Knob Hill Gang record. I haven't got that, but we made a record. It's called the Knob Hill Gang.
Was that Ernie? That wasn't Ernie Carson, was it?
No, that was a record that was put out by Jimmy Diamond.
Oh, I know the disc. I'm just trying to think of who the
personnel?
The trumpeter, yeah.
Yeah, there was, I'm going to line it up. That was Ernie Figueroa and
Ernie,
Buddy Powers on trumpet. And Glenn Kerr played some of the bass, and George Butterfield played the bass, and Jerry played trombone, Jerry Butson.
Yeah, why don't you say a word about Jerry? He passed away, about 10 years ago?
Christmas, around Christmas time, 84. We played a job, I bore you to death. We played a job party. We'd been playing it every year at a man's house. And this particular night, we played it. And then I went down to my mother-in-law's. It was just before Christmas. And I came back, and John Markham told me, we're going to play a funeral for Jerry. And I said, oh, you're kidding? And, you know, so forth. And he passed away within a week. He stayed in the hospital, I believe. And he was an excellent trombone player. I like to describe him that if you could throw 1,000 $1 bills and say to him, play 1,000 choruses, one chorus of every song you know, and I'll give you $1, and he would play the $1,000 out of your hand.
Yeah. He was a much loved musician, I guess.
Oh, he was just beautiful. He's on this Knob Hill Gang record. It's a record. It's not a CD.
Yeah. You have any favorites on that album?
I think I played a chorus in Indiana that I liked, and that's, you know, it was. But I what I pride myself on, and the only time I brag is that I'm a good ensemble clarinet player.
Well, that's saying a lot.
Yeah, what the problem with clarinet players is they don't know what to do with. They know what to do with the clarinet if you give them a solo, but they don't know hardly anything to do with when they get with a good. When I say good Dixieland trumpet player, a trumpet player that knows the leads to all those. As I call them, the bottom 40. I have to also say that Cuz Cousineau, the drummer and also former disc jockey at K-Jazz, he used that first. So I'm going to give him credit for that. But I want to tell you...
Well, wait a minute. I want to dig in a little on this first. Now, I want you to tell me, and I want you to tell everyone listening, what a good clarinet player does... backing up a good trumpeter in a proper band.
You know, I don't think I want to tell you that because Mal Sharp, we got to talking. He says, you just seem to know where to go. There's an old man. He's 80 years old. His name is George Fleming, trumpet player. Do you know him?
Yes.
Have you ever interviewed him?
No, I'm trying to. The trick is there aren't that many recordings of him.
Yeah, right. Well, he is, you know, he always, when I played at this bar over in Sausalito called the No Name Bar, he always complimented me. He said, you always seem to know where I'm going. You seem to follow me, you know. And then there's Jack Buck's son, Tom Buck. Mm-hmm. He plays trumpet. He plays very well. These are the last two, what I call Dixieland trumpet players that I played with. He says, oh, man, he says, you're not going to quit. He says, you just know what to do. Well, I'll tell you, you know, the clarinet has... Well, I guess it's got three registers. You know, it's got the low, what they call the Chalamone. It's got the middle register. You play that middle register by using the thumb. I'm looking at Harvey. The thumb of the left hand. It's not an octave key. It's a register. Mm-hmm. It jumps 12 notes. This is your low E. Mm-hmm. When you press this key, it skips this E and plays B. That's a 12th, or a concert D. That's a D. That's another A.
So the three ranges are Chalamot?
Chalamot, middle register, mm-hmm. and the upper register. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to the upper register, you're not just putting one finger down, mama, one finger down, daddy. You're switching. You're playing two fingers maybe from the right hand, maybe one finger from the left hand. Harvey, shake your head or say yes.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And what the clarinet player does, if he wants to look good, he plays, if the trumpet player is playing quarter notes, the clarinet player plays eighth notes. If the trumpet player is playing eighth notes, the clarinet player might play a few 16th notes. But if the clarinet player gets carried away, he will just destroy the punching that the trumpet player is doing. Mm-hmm. Now, Mal Sharp said, you know, you could give lessons on how to play this type of clarinet and make a living out of it. Well, I don't intend to. There's one thing that the clarinet player, he should kind of know the tune. If they're playing I Got Rhythm, just mm-hmm. that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And they play it with the, I Got Rhythm, that isn't a tag at the end. I think that's part of the tune. And you play it all the way through. Some people leave off the tag. but anyway, and what he does is, if the higher the trumpet player goes,
mm-hmm.
the more I believe that the clarinet player stays in the middle register.
Mm-hmm.
It's useless to play the clarinet in the low register. Now I'm making demands, perhaps, and maybe clarinet players will disagree with me, but if the trumpet player is playing in his upper register, the clarinet player, if he starts to play in his upper register, you've got no bottom.
Mm-hmm. You leave a hole in the music.
There's a hole. And if the clarinet player plays in the lower register while the trumpet player is playing in the upper register, you've got too far a space.
Mm-hmm.
If the trumpet player is playing in his middle register, then perhaps the clarinet player can afford to play slightly, not too much, in his upper register and a little bit below his middle register. That's all I can describe to you on that.
Well, that's very clear. I don't think I've heard it stated more clearly. What about in terms of the rhythmic patterns? Well, you know, you did describe that the notes should be, that the clarinet notes are going to be shorter.
The clarinet player's notes should be shorter and more than what the trumpet player, but I also specified values. If mm-hmm. he's just punching like that, the clarinet player can punch maybe double that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if he's playing, the clarinet player then can go maybe four times the speed, or at least three times, because then it begets. Then you're just getting a clarinet solo,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's not it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not it.
What about in terms of the melody? Are you sort of devising a counterpoint melody to the melody?
You're listening to him. You're on his neck,
mm-hmm.
right on his neck, and you're partially trying to play another melody, but partially, if you play another melody, then you're actually getting in intervals,
mm-hmm.
and those guys 60, 70 years ago in New Orleans never tried to play intervals with each other. Then the arrangers, both black and white, if we had records, we could just do this with records.
Mm-hmm.
They
like
wrote
a Don Redman or
Don Redman, and also in the Jimmy Lunsford band, they wrote for clarinet, trumpet, and trombone.
Mm-hmm.
That was the trumpet player, Cy Oliver. Jimmy Mundy, another musician,
outstanding arranger. Yes.
Yes, he wrote for Benny Goodman, and he wrote some clarinet, trumpet, and trombone. But then they were all together. They were playing the same beat, like
uh-huh.
whatever they were playing. Nobody played extra notes. They mm-hmm. played all together, the three of them,
mm-hmm.
for maybe 8 or 16 bars. Then they brought in the full band, which gave it a change.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual Dixieland players, the three horns, Kid Ory, and you take Kid Ory, you take Louis Armstrong, and you take Johnny Dodds, I don't think there's any records where they actually are playing three-part. Actually, there's the
right.
three-part harmony.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
it's more
I'm
of
wrong.
A counterpoint, more of a tapestry of musical lines.
It was three musical lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, okay, moving right along now. Speaking of musical lines, one of the big inspirations in your life, as you said earlier, was Benny Goodman.
Yeah.
You want to talk about Benny a little?
I started September of 1935. Here comes another story, David.
Great. Lay it on me.
aren't you getting bored?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, I started September of 1935, and my brother... who was 11 years older than me, was saying, have you ever heard of Benny Goodman now that you're playing the clarinet? And I said, no, Sam. You know, it was the kid brother routine. You know, he couldn't stand me hardly. He was a wonderful man, though. But he said, well, there's a Benny Goodman now. We used to hear Benny Goodman at 9 o'clock at night coming out of New York City. And a year ago, 1934, there was three bands, Benny Goodman, Kel Murray, and Xavier Cugat. And they were put out by the National Biscuit Company. It was the Let's Dance program. Now, you wouldn't know anything about that, he'd say to me. And I'd say, no, you know. And I still haven't heard this Benny Goodman, you know. So long about January of 1936, it's like I began to wake up. And I heard the original four Goodman things, Stomp, what do you call that? Stomp.
Stomping at the Savoy?
No.
Shirt Tail?
King Porter Stomp.
King Porter.
Yeah, King Porter, and I Got You in the Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea. And I started hearing that, and I thought, oh, that's the clarinet. That's what Sammy's talking about, you know. So I was here comes a story for you. I was in the School for the Blind over in Berkeley. I was in the fourth grade, and Benny Goodman had finished his routine at the Palomar. I didn't even know he played the Palomar. I didn't even know what the Palomar was, you know. But the band got a job at the Congress Hotel, Joseph's Urban Room of the Congress Hotel. Dave, there's records of this, what I'm telling about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have them, but there are records out of this band. So one Sunday night, we all had to go into supper. And I went into supper, but I had got to hear a couple of songs. So the next Sunday night, the boys' hall, we had to go into supper, and I told the man that ran the two men that were running the dining room. We were all in our teens, but the four men that ran the boys' hall were all in their late teens or early 20s. Mind you, this is 1935. Nobody had a dollar or a penny, but they gave these men room and board to take care of these blind boys, see that they were fed, see that their hair was combed, put to bed from the age of 6 to 19, shut down the whole building at night. And there was two of them. There were two of them on all day or all night. If they weren't on, they were studying, you know, to do their classes at Cal, which was a few blocks, a quarter of a mile away. The school was up by the Claremont Hotel. Now, if you can picture where the campus was. Okay, so I told this one guy, I said, no, I'm not coming in the kitchen. I'm not coming in the dining room. I want to hear Benny Goodman. I don't care. I don't want to eat. And the guy was 19 years old, and he said, you've got to come in the dining room and eat, or otherwise I will lose my job here, and I need this job, so you're coming in the dining room. What I will do is you make a lot of noise with your knife and fork after you get in the dining room, and you can take your sandwiches. I'll throw you out of the dining room every week, and you can make noise, and every week I'll give you my key, and you go down and open my room and listen to Benny Goodman play.
So this is so that you could sneak out of the meal to hear Benny when he was on the radio.
When he was on the radio.
Wow.
They were giving swing concerts, 5 o'clock our time, 7 o'clock Chicago time.
So then did you start trying to imitate Benny's playing?
Well, then I just, as I say, it took me 2 years to wake up. It's like, I didn't know. I was 12, November 10th of 1935, and then I became 13, still didn't really know. But as I've told you, once I realized that my sisters and brothers were working, my sisters also worked at S&W in the cannery with the peaches, and my two brothers worked on fishing boats, and my other brother, he sold papers here in San Francisco. And they all were doing something. And I thought, God, I've got to get out of here, and I've got to be able to get a job. And I met clarinet players in 1942, and they said, well, by the way you behave, you're not going to go to college. You should get out of the school now and start taking our jobs because we're all in the service. And I said, no, they want me to stay another year. And they said, well, go ahead. That's money you're going to lose because they were all in the service in the war, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed till June of 43. I joined the union, and I went to work about four hours after I joined the union. Was because they needed musicians.
This was 42 then?
43.
So you did become... Now, so you were playing in a swing, Benny Goodman style?
I was playing, by that time, I was playing tenor and clarinet. I was playing Jumping Out in the Woodside on my Busher tenor, and we had a trumpet, tenor, bass, drums, and piano, and we accompanied about four or five girls who'd come up there and sing. Some would strip. This was a place on Turk Street. And I did that for 6 months.
Do you remember what the place on Turk was called?
What it was called?
Yeah.
Oh, it was called the Tin Pan Alley.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It was called the Tin Pan Alley. And it was, we played behind the bar. You had to get underneath the bar and then climb five steps, no railing, and you were on the bandstand. Now, in those days, they had what they called the Shore Patrol and the MPs.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept track of the... kept the four Fs away from the soldiers and sailors and Marines. And several nights
was a sort of fight? Was that
God. I mean, I can tell you that several times I got the right place finally after I did it twice. I made my way down the bar, and I ended up in the girls' bathroom a couple of times to get away from the fights.
Oh, boy.
You know, but I had no trouble. The women realized I was blind. So I had no trouble. But then I realized where I should make the turn, and I'd go in the men's bathroom till the fight was over. And boy, they'd knock over tables, chairs, screams. It was, you know, it was the way of the Saturday night because all the four Fs went out, all of us four Fs that were, I was working 6 nights a week, and the four Fs were working the shipyards and taking their pay and throwing it over the bar.
Do you have any favorite Benny Goodman tunes that you like to play, or that records of his that are favorites of yours?
I play supposedly by my mood. Tonight I might go in there because I'm revved up that I practiced a couple hours and did it right, and I might go in there and play, for maybe an hour. The best clarinet you ever heard, and then the rest of the 3 hours, it's all downhill. So I really don't his songs. I really don't. It depends how I grip the clarinet, and how I feel. Sometimes I'll play Jumping at the Woodside, or I'll play blues, you know.
How about Memories of You?
Well, I everybody's played that. I you know.